To see you all again this morning, and I'm going to talk about some recent work with Catherine Moisberger. I'll give you the reference towards the end for the paper. What I want to do today is give a fairly basic talk, I hope, just explaining the basic ideas behind Hopf algebra gauge theory. So our goal in this project was to take lattice gauge theory for an ordinary group and generalize that as conservatively as possible just to accommodate more general Hopf algebras. Let's see. Does this thing work? So why would you want to do this? There's lots of motivations for possibly wanting to write down lattice gauge theory for Hopf algebra. One reason is just that anything deep about groups, anything you can do with groups that's a good idea, you should try to do with Hopf algebras as well. Hopf algebras are groups, really. They're just groups in a different context. They're groups in the category of vector spaces. So in order to write down the axioms for a group, you really need to duplicate an element, because you need to write down like G times G inverse equals 1. And that's the co-multiplication. And if you're really systematic about it, then you can see that Hopf algebras are no different than groups. They're just groups in a different category. So you should really try doing it for anything for groups that you can do with, anything for Hopf algebras that you can already do with groups. But another motivation is that we'd like to have a gauge theoretic understanding of some existing models. For example, one way to think of the Turiya-Vero model, for a particular quantum group anyway, is as a regularization of 3D quantum gravity, as a regularization of the Ponzano-Reggi model. And the Ponzano-Reggi model is dual to a particular gauge theory for a group. But there's no gauge theory for a Hopf algebra that corresponds to that without really writing down what a lattice Hopf algebra gauge theory is like. There's lots of other models that hint at Hopf algebra gauge theory. Combinatorial quantization of Chern-Simons theory, we'll be revisiting that later. Other specifically sort of gauge theoretic models, but usually for specific algebras and using specific things about those algebras, specific bases, specific kinds of lattices, and so on. And so we wanted to do something really general where you can see all of these things within a unified context. And of course, Kataev models. And now is a good time, I think, to thank the organizers for inviting me to talk about this, because this is actually the thing that got me and Catherine thinking about this originally. When you look at Kataev models, you can't help but think, this really looks a lot like things that I'm used to in gauge theory, at least if you're a gauge theorist. But it doesn't seem quite that yet. And so I'm not going to talk about it, but right after the coffee break and after my talk, Catherine is going to follow up with this talk on explaining how Kataev models are actually an example of what I'm going to be talking about here. So this will be a series of talks this morning. So our strategy in doing this is, as I said, just to be as systematic as possible. So in particular, we can use the free functor that takes finite sets to vector spaces. It just takes a set to the vector space spanned by that set. That's a functor, and we can apply that to everything in sight in ordinary lattice gauge theory. The idea is that sets, of course, become vector spaces. Actually, even better, sets become coalgebras. Why is that? Because any set is a comonoid in a unique way. And so you can, the comonoid structure is just the thing that duplicates an element of a set. It goes from G to G cross G. Groups, of course, become Hopf algebras. Group actions become Hopf algebra modules, and so on. Just by applying this functor to everything in sight. And so the idea is to first apply this, and then conservatively generalize. I mean, only generalize something when something breaks, and you can't do it for a general Hopf algebra, right? But other than that, we want to just copy ordinary lattice gauge theory as much as possible. So let me go ahead and tell you what the result of this work is. The result is that you reproduce Hamiltonian quantum Chern-Simons theory in this combinatorial quantization scheme. So we get a topological invariant quantum moduli space, which is like the analog of the moduli space of classical connections. And this thing is known, but it's usually derived by starting with classical Trans-Siemens theory and quantizing Poisson structures in order to get it. And here we're just going to start from some simple axioms, generalizing lattice gauge theory to Hopf algebras, and we'll end up with the same quantum moduli space. So there's the big result. I'm going to skip some of this stuff about Hopf algebras because we had some good introductions to Hopf algebras yesterday, and I'll be using pretty much the same notation as others have used already in this conference. So let me talk instead about what lattice gauge theory is like. For those of you who don't know, in lattice gauge theory, we start off with a graph. It might be some more specific kind of graph than this, but let's just take the most general thing that we can, some finite graph. So it's got vertices and it has edges. It can have multiple edges and it can have loops. Anything's fair game at this point. And a connection is a way of labeling the edges in this graph by group elements. So for our group G, if that's the gauge group of the theory. And so G to the E would be our set of connections, or our space of connections. And then there's a group that acts on that. It's the group of gauge transformations, which is just all of the ways of labeling vertices by group elements. And there is an action of this group. This one's only a set, but this is what you should really think of as a group. It's just the Cartesian product of copies of the gauge group, one for each vertex. And it acts, I'm falling off of the bottom of the screen here. It acts in this way. So for example, this group element A1, because of the orientation here, there's different conventions, but in my convention, we pre-multiply by G2, since that's the target vertex, and then we post-multiply by G3 inverse, because that's the source vertex. So we want to copy the same thing in the language of Hopf algebras. I need a hockey stick. So all of the stuff that we've got for an ordinary gauge theory for a finite group G is over here. So we've got the gauge group. I have the group of gauge transformations, the space of connections. As I just said, there's the gauge action. And all of that stuff I can just apply my free functor to get the same kind of stuff over here. These have the same names, meaning slightly different things in this world. But I get gauge transformations are now the group algebra to the tensor power V, and so on. And I get this gauge action of the gauge transformations acting on connections. Also important in ordinary group-based gauge theory is functions of the connection. And I'll write functions as A star, because actually this is the one thing that's already sort of Hopfish. If we're talking about, let's always assume that I'm working with complex Hopf algebras. Functions of the connection, that's just functions of the group elements. And then if I apply the free functor to that, then that's just linear functions in this world. So this is really the same thing in these two cases. Here it really is the dual as a vector space to the space of connections. But then I have the idea of observables, and observables are just gauge invariant functions. So here's a particular function f, and if it's gauge invariant if g doesn't do anything. Over in the Hopf world, you can't say it doesn't do anything. You have to say that it doesn't do anything up to the co-unit, because otherwise this wouldn't be a linear equation. You can't just delete that that g on the right side of the equation without using the co-unit in the Hopf algebra. But all of this works perfectly in parallel. And so here's already our first example of a Hopf-Algebra gauge theory. You just take an ordinary group-based gauge theory and apply this functor. And so the question is, what are more general ones like? In particular, what is it like when the Hopf-Algebra is not co-commutative? Again, I'm falling off the bottom of the screen. Sorry, I don't have too many slides like that. Yeah, so the goal is to generalize to a finite dimensional Hopf-Algebra, in particular in the non-co-commutative case.
Top line, perhaps the text will move up.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you. Great.
Oh.
And now it won't advance. That's interesting. Let's see. Presentation. Yay. Okay, good. So, how do gauge transformations work in the general case? I want to copy the idea of gauge transformations as closely as possible. The gauge action should now be, this is my Hopf algebra of connections, and this is my vector space this is my Hopf algebra of gauge transformations, my vector space of connections. I've got this, I want this action to be just like the one in the ordinary group case. But the problem is, in the group case, whenever I've got a group element sitting at this vertex, it acts on all of the other vertices. And that's not a linear thing. I can't duplicate a group element in a linear way. In fact, the prerogative of the co-multiplication is duplicating elements. That's what we should really be doing. We need to make copies of it using the co-multiplication and then distribute those to the edges, to those edge ends, and then let those act. Of course, if H is not a co-commutative co-algebra, then it really makes a difference how I distribute those. And so it seems immediately that I need more structure than I do in the ordinary, in the co-commutative case. Namely, I need a total order of the edge ends coming into each vertex. But other than that, I want to copy the gauge action just as closely as possible. So suppose I've got this little Hopf algebra element representing the connection. This is just one factor in a tensor product. But how is this supposed to transform if these are the orders of my edge ends at these two vertices, and these are the elements in the Hopf algebra of gauge transformations? How is it supposed to transform? Well, just like in groups, I first have to split this according to the order using the co-multiplication, and then A in this big tensor product just goes to, it gets pre-multiplied by G prime 4 in Swedler notation because that's the target, and it gets post-multiplied by S of, by the antipode of G1. So, except for this one thing of needing an order, we're going to copy the action as closely as possible. Make sense? Of course, once we've introduced this additional structure, we've actually really introduced a two-dimensional structure into our graphs, where we didn't have anything at the beginning. It was just an ordinary graph. But so a cyclically ordered graph, a graph with cyclically ordered edge ends at each vertex, is a ribbon graph, which means we get a surface with boundary. And we also get a surface, a closed surface, after sewing disks in. Maybe not everyone is familiar with this, so let me just illustrate this quickly with a drawing. We can always draw one of these graphs in the plane so that the cyclic ordering is always the same direction. So we'll take the cyclic ordering to always be counterclockwise in any one of these vertices. And then knowing that information, knowing just that information, we can thicken each one of these edges into a ribbon just by saying, okay, I'm going to go right next to this one, and I have to preserve the orientation. So I'll fatten each one of these dots out into a disk, but then I'll also do this, right? This is not really in the plane. I'm just drawing a diagram of it in the plane. But preserving the orientation from one to the next determines these ribbons. And if we do this on the entire graph, then what we end up with is an actual graph of ribbons whose boundary is a bunch of circles. There's a circle that does this. However it comes around again, it'll eventually end up at that point. And so we get a surface with boundary immediately, but then just by sewing disks onto those circles, we get a closed surface. And so there's really a fundamental two-dimensional nature to what we're doing, just by assigning orders to the edge ends. We've got a bit more than just a cyclically ordered graph, cyclically ordered edge ends. We've got total order, and that just amounts to picking a starting point in the cyclic order, which is called a coelium. And so this is a ciliated ribbon graph, what we end up with.
So do these orders, the connections have to be kind of consistent? I mean, if you go so from like one vertex to another along one edge, then that kind of implies, so you have your ribbon has some twist or something in it, and then when you get back to the, and then you take another edge back to the first one, you have...
So the point is, if I were to an ant marching along this surface, I see counterclockwise here.
Right.
And when I get over here, I have to see counterclockwise again. So the only thing I can't do an odd number of half twists. I can't do this, because that would get me, that would reverse the orientation when I got to the other one.
Right, but if the other one were clockwise, you'd have to do that half twist.
Right, exactly.
But then suppose you go back along an edge to the first place. Is it always going to be?
It always works. You always get an oriented surface.
But, yeah. But it's acceptable to have like a full twist.
Yeah, because it's not actually embedded in the plane, so there's no difference really between a full twist and no twist at all.
So there's no and
there's no embedding space at all.
There's no kind of intrinsic way to tell if you've done that or not.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not actually sitting in any embedding space. Okay, right, so we've introduced this fundamental two-dimensional nature just by adding non-co-commutativity. So far what we've got is, in generalizing to ordinary, to Hopf algebras that might not be co-commutative, in place of the gauge group, I've got a Hopf algebra. In place of the graph, I've got a ciliated ribbon graph, and then everything else is very much the same. And things work great up to this point. There's no wrinkles in the carpet up to this point. And if this were the end of the story, then I could wrap up pretty quickly. But some interesting things happens when you actually look at gauge invariance, and in particular, look at gauge invariance of functions. So observables are gauge invariant functions. So what are observables in ordinary gauge theory? Well, they're functions of the connection. We'll take complex valued functions that are gauge invariant in the way that we said before. And functions, of course, form an algebra. They can multiply just pointwise functions like this. They form an algebra in an obvious way. It's just the algebra of functions on the group, tensor product of that E times. And observables form a subalgebra. Same thing happens over here. The functions also form an algebra in an obvious way. The function, the space of functions is really just the Hopf algebra, tensor power of the Hopf algebra. So you've got one copy, the dual Hopf algebra. You have one copy of the dual Hopf algebra for each edge. And that's an algebra in an obvious way. And fortunately, observables are not a subalgebra unless H is co-commutative. And the problem is this word, the obvious way, is not the way that this should be an algebra. So this actually was the hardest part of just getting this project going, I think, was figuring out what in the world is going on with this incompatibility between, is there something wrong with the gauge action? Is there something wrong with the algebra? Eventually, this is the strategy that we took. The new approach, we just modify our approach. Rather than saying, okay, it's an algebra in an obvious way, we want to generalize the algebra structure on this. So as a vector space, it's still that. I'm going to generalize it in some way so that observables really do form a subalgebra. Because if you want to do things like you do in ordinary gauge theory, you need that. So I'll explain what that algebra structure is. But first, let me say a little bit about why the obvious algebra structure doesn't work. In order to get a gauge invariant subalgebra, we got this gauge invariant space, but in order to make it a subalgebra, we really need the gauge action to preserve the algebra structure. Or because that algebra structure is defined in terms of the coalgebra structure on the space of connections, we need it to preserve the coalgebra structure on the space of connections. And in the language of Hopf theorists, at least, that's saying that we want A to be a G-module coalgebra. If you're more inclined towards categorical language, then that means we want it to be not just a module and a coalgebra, but a module in the category of coalgebras for the, or a coalgebra in the category of modules for the gauge Hopf algebra. So either way you look at it, these are the equations. We want the co-multiplication to preserve the action, and also the co-unit to preserve the action. And this happens automatically in the group case. It doesn't happen in general if we just take the tensor product algebra structure, co-algebra structure on the space of connections, unless H happens to be co-commutative. So for example, we don't have to look at very big graphs in order to see this. Suppose this is our entire universe here. It's this one edge graph. And so the action just looks like this. I've got two Hopf algebra elements acting on this one in the middle, according to the usual action. If it were a module coalgebra, one of the things I would need it to satisfy is that. But what actually happens is that the left-hand side here is equal to this, whereas the right-hand side is equal to that. And if you squint, those look the same. But if you look more carefully, you see that there's just a couple of factors in the co-multiplication switched here. The H primes match up, the H's don't. And no matter what you try, believe me, we tried everything, these kind of problems keep coming up. So in this case, this fails because S, which is part of an action, we're mixing up an action that involves just regular multiplication with one that involves the antipode. And the antipode is a coalgebra anti-homomorphism, and that just messes things up. But S is not actually the only problem. It's not even the main problem. Another example is a graph like this, where I've just got one vertex. I'm going to ignore all the other vertices, so I just don't even let them act as gauge transformations. All of these edges, of course, get acted on by gauge transformation living at this vertex. But the tensor product of module coalgebras is, in general, not a module coalgebra. So you get all kinds of annoying factors in the co-multiplication that just get switched around. So what's going on here? Well, one clue is that because we've got these factors in the co-multiplication getting mixed up, what we really need is something that relates delta and delta op. And of course, that's exactly what the R matrix in a quasi-triangular Hopf algebra does. So let's stick with quasi-triangular Hopf algebras. This is one, this isn't the entire, all of the defining properties of the R matrix, but this is the important one for our purposes right now. It at least lets us switch the factors in the co-multiplication. And this does help. For example, coming back to this example here, if I just change the coalgebra structure on my space of connections is really just H. And instead of using the ordinary co-multiplication, I use the co-multiplication times R21. That's the R matrix with the two factors in the tensor product switched. This gives us a module coalgebra. And if we take the dual of that, that gives us a module algebra structure on. Dual of that is the module algebra structure on A star, the space of functions. And observables, the invariant things, are really a subalgebra of that. So that works. Using the tensor product, using the R matrix, you can also solve this problem with something that's basically braided tensor products, which were studied by Majid in the 90s. I'm not going to write down the details right now, but we'll actually see it in just a couple of minutes. But the point is, how do we figure it out systematically? How do I figure out where I've got to stick in R matrices in order to get things to work? And our approach was just to decide on what axioms a Hopf algebra gauge theory should satisfy. We've already seen a couple of them. We wanted to mimic the gauge action in the group case. And we also wanted to give a co-module algebra of connections, and therefore a module algebra of functions. So we needed to interact nicely with the action and the multiplication of functions to interact nicely. But one more thing we haven't mentioned, we'd like the algebra to be local. So let me say what it means for an algebra to be local in this sense. So suppose, our space of functions is really just the tensor product of copies of, so now my H turned into a K. K equals H on this slide. So there's my Hopf algebra H. And because of this, we get natural embeddings of K star into A. For each edge, that's just including the factor that's there. And we also get embeddings of K star, tensor K star into A, taking two edges. So that's just picking out two edges and only considering the functions that are supported on that. And then we'll say that the algebra structure is local if the image of each one of these is a subalgebra. Images of each one of these is a subalgebra. So if I'm multiplying functions that are supported on the same edge, then I don't get something that's supported on an edge over here, right? And similarly with two edges. And also, if two edges have no common vertex, then things should commute. So if I write alpha sub e as the image of alpha under this inclusion, then these commute, and it's just equal to the tensor product of on the those
edges. For this definition, you're specifically using these I mean, you need, it's only for an algebra that's a tensor product like this,
mm-hmm.
right? So how could 1 and 2 fail?
Well, I mean, this is just a map of as vector spaces. Right.
So the algebra has to be the tensor product, but the IEs don't necessarily have to be these kind of
right.
obvious embeddings.
A priori, it could just
okay.
be. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So with this idea of locality, we can write down a definition of half-algebra gauge theory. That's pretty short. So suppose I've got a ciliated ribbon graph, and H is a finite dimensional half algebra. Gauge theory on this graph, which I didn't call gamma up there, but it's called gamma, with values in H consists of this Hopf algebra and this vector space equipped with a coalgebra structure so that the dual algebra structure on A star is local in the sense that I just described. And a left G module structure on the space of connections such that we get a module coalgebra, as we said before, and this action is as expected for gauge transformations on a single edge. In other words, if E is an edge that's not a loop and V is a vertex that's not an endpoint of E, well, vertices that are not endpoints of E should not affect E. So not affecting them just means we feed that gauge transformation into the co-unit. And otherwise, if these are the target and source maps, then we act either by pre-multiplying by H or post-multiplying by S of H, just as before, according to the orientation. So what we then do is consider this example again. We're thinking of this as sort of a degenerate graph where each edge only has one endpoint. I'm just ignoring what could happen at any other at the other endpoints of these edges. So the only gauge transformation is the one labeled by H right at this vertex. For H being quasi-triangular, there's an essentially unique algebra structure on the space of functions that's compatible with the Hopf algebra gauge theory axioms. And it works like this. This is the braided tensor product. It just depends on the order of these edge ends. If I is less than J, then it's just alpha times beta is alpha and beta in those spots. If it's the other way around, then we use this braiding that is given by the R matrix in our quasi-triangular Hopf algebra. It turns out for I equals J, we have two choices. We can either take the normal choice where we just multiply alpha and beta together, or we can take the twisted version that looks like this. And we can do this independently for each one of the edge ends. So I can just say, all right, I'm going to pick those two to be twisted, and the other ones are going to be normal, which might seem strange, but these are the only choices that we've got being compatible with the Hopf algebra gauge theory. if we also want to be able to reverse these arrows, then it's helpful to take the algebra to be semi-simple. More generally, you can do it with a ribbon Hopf algebra. If it's semi-simple, then reversing the edge just corresponds to the antipode, which is what you would expect from ordinary lattice gauge theory, where you just use the inverse to reverse an edge. so our strategy, actually, is to just use this fact and locality to dissect our graph into pieces that look like this one. And the trick is, on each one of these, on each one of these original edges, I split that into two. And one of these has to be normal, and the other one has to be twisted. So they always come in those kinds of pairs. But just doing this cutting of the graph gives us, via the co-multiplication in H star, it gives us an injective linear map from the space of functions on here to the tensor product of the spaces of functions on each one of these little neighborhoods of a single vertex. And then the theorem is that the image of this space of functions under this map is a subalgebra and a submodule of of this big tensor product. And pulling this structure back to the original graph gives the algebra of functions of a Hopf algebra gauge theory according to our axioms. So from that, here's where all of the R's come in. They just come in these these twisted tensor products. And then using this map and pulling back to get the algebra structure, you can work out in any particular graph what goes on. And it looks complicated for a particular graph, especially if it has loops and multiple edges. We work out explicitly what that looks like. But it all comes from just pulling back the algebra structure on these local neighborhoods. So let me just mention and summarize some results. So the Hopf algebra gauge theory, because of the construction that I just sketched, is determined by the axioms, just by locality and the module co-algebra requirement, and having the expected kind of behavior for the local gauge action. In any Hopf algebra gauge theory, the space of observables is actually a subalgebra, which is good, the algebra of observables. And some examples, of course, the example that I mentioned at the beginning, we, of course, recover something equivalent to ordinary lattice gauge theory for a finite group if we just use the group algebra of that group as our Hopf algebra. Because there, all of this twisting by the R matrix is trivial, since the R matrix is trivial. I don't think I want H equals D of H. If the gauge Hopf algebra is the Drenfeld double of a Hopf algebra, finite dimensional Hopf algebra, then for a single edge, the algebra of observables is the Heisenberg double. If we take a single looped edge, then gives us the Drenfeld double back again. This algebra of observables isn't new to us. It's just the way of deriving it that's new. And it's a surprise that it comes out this way without having to look at Trin-Simons theory and quantize Poisson structures and so on. But this algebra of functions corresponds to the lattice algebra in combinatorial quantization. And it's a topological invariant of the surface with boundary obtained from the ribbon graph. A bit more that we can do. Everything in ordinary gauge theory should have an analog. So we can talk about holonomies of connections. Holonomy of a Hopf algebra valued connection works like this. We have this holonomy functor, which goes from the path groupoid into this algebra viewed as a one object category, which I'll explain in just a moment. So the path groupoid in a graph is just the groupoid. It's really just the free groupoid on the graph, where you take the objects to be vertices and the morphisms to be equivalence classes of edge paths. So if I go back and forth along an edge, that doesn't count. I can shrink that down. And, actually, since graphs are one-dimensional, you could also say that it's the same as the restriction of the fundamental groupoid. It's really up to homotopy equivalence in that one-dimensional case. It's just because it's one-dimensional. And then this algebra. So we're talking about linear maps from the space of connections into the gauge-hop algebra. So what this is saying is, for each path, I get a map that takes a connection to an element of the gauge-hop algebra. That sounds a lot, at least, like what the holonomy is supposed to do. And the way that this becomes an algebra is by this formula. We take, if I have two such linear functions, then I'd like to be able to act with both of them, but I can't do that because I don't have enough arguments. But I can if I first double the arguments using the co-multiplication. And then in order to get back to something that's just in H, I multiply them together. So this gives me a product, which gives me the structure of an associative algebra. An associative algebra is the same thing as a linear category with one object. And so this gives me a functor that I can think of as the holonomy, and it reduces to the definition of holonomy in the ordinary group case as well. Once I have holonomy, of course, I can talk about curvature. And in particular, since I'm on a ribbon graph, I've got faces. Ribbon graphs have faces because they're the disks that I would sew in order to get a closed surface. And so if I take the holonomy along an edge path that corresponds to one of these faces, then that's the curvature of the connection at that face. If the curvature of the connection for every face is the identity, is the unit, then we say that the connection is flat. And moreover, there is a projection operator that we get from the algebra of observables to the algebra of observables. Its image is what's known as the quantum moduli space. And this is really the analog. It's a topological invariant, but not a topological invariant of the manifold with boundary, rather the closed manifold that I get by sewing disks in. This is the quantum analog, essentially, of HOM pi 1 G mod G, which is the moduli space of flat G connections on manifold. Okay. So there's a lot of stuff there, and I didn't tell you all of the details, obviously. But the details and lots of references can be found in our paper here, Hopf Algebra Gauge Theory on a Ribbon Graph with Catherine. And also, to hear more about this stuff, come to Catherine's talk right after the coffee break. And just thank you guys for your attention. Yes.
I mean, this looks a bit like if you go from two Rivero TQFTs to the full formalism of TQFTs. I was wondering what the invariant you get for your two-dimensional surfaces, this algebra as a vector space, is that then just...
I think Catherine will be talking about this essentially, right?
So basically, your first question was our motivation to understand this, that we can make a Szeketai lattice models as a Hamiltonian version of Torrey-Pirro, and the other one as a Hamiltonian version of Reshetykin-Torrey. And but the Hopf algebra gauge theory would assign to a surface this quantum moduli algebra. That would basically what the Rashid-Tikhin-Turayev would assign to the surface. But this has been known before. This was achieved already in the framework of combinatorial quantization. It's just that from the combinatorial quantization in its original form, it's very hard to see how the two theories are related.
Yeah, so the thing here is just getting it completely axiomatically from generalizing gauge theory.
You had on the slide, but I don't think you said a comment that this choice of a priori you need an actual ordering the edges at every vertex to define everything, and then you sort of on the slide said actually only requires a cyclic ordering. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So you need the cyclic ordering. The gauge theory really does depend on the cyclic ordering. It seems to depend on the actual total ordering of the edge ends, but when you go down to the algebra of observables, that's isomorphic in a controlled way. So it's very much like you don't actually need orientations on edges in order to do lattice gauge theory. You have to pick them in order to do any calculations, but then in the end, it doesn't matter what you picked. And it's very much the same with, this is actually dual to it. In order to calculate in non-abelian gauge theory, in order to calculate the holonomy around a face, you have to pick a starting point. But the theory doesn't depend on which starting point you picked for each one of the faces. And similarly, doesn't depend on which starting point you pick for each one of the dual faces, which are just these edge ends coming into the vertices.
Why do you need a semi-simplicity for the holonomy quantum?
You need semi-simplicity. Okay, so for the holonomy, you have oriented edges, and we do have a way in the path groupoid, I want to be able to take paths that go along an edge or along the reverse of an edge. I can use both orientations. And in order to take the reverse of the edge, what I really need is a Ribbon-Hopf algebra. So not quite as strong, but it turns out you don't get a functor if you use that ribbon structure. You really need, when you reverse an edge for the semi-simple case, you're really just applying the antipode. For the Ribbon-Hopf algebra, you're doing something more general than that, and it just doesn't work out right. If you maybe Catherine has a better answer for that, but
I mean, you can make it work out if you assume that there's something in each representation as a square root of the ribbon element, but then either you have to assume that, or you have to put in R matrices by hand at certain paths, which is not so natural, and also the resulting functor doesn't have so nice properties. Like you could consider closed simple curves on the surface and look at the holonomy and what does it do and how does it behave, and it's nicer in that case. And if you put the R matrices by hand, or if you take the other formulation where you assume that there's a square root of the ribbon element in each representation, the properties are not so nice.
You showed that this reproduces this feature of the Rashid-Tikhin-Turayev variant, but we also thought a bit about what happens when you don't require flattens, because then you just get a generalization of ordinary base theory, and you could introduce the Hamiltonian of the ordinary base theory to generalize this picture.
Part of that is in there already. So we get this lattice algebra, which is also in Yeah, so just the ordinary lattice, the ordinary algebra of functions before before imposing flatness, you get this lattice algebra that's also known from the same work on combinatorial quantization. And that's, yeah, it's an invariant of the manifold with boundary, because you're like cutting out those faces and saying, okay, it doesn't actually need to be flat at that face. Essentially the idea.
But in terms of getting a Hamiltonian at the spectral the gauge theory, that's not something you're interested in, that, or?
Interested in it, yeah, yes, I haven't thought about it enough.
Okay. Is there a natural, if you test one version of this, analogous to the way you gauge theory, one form and two forms?
Not that I know.
Okay.
I mean, here, yeah. No, I can't say anything concrete about that.
Any more questions?
When you have a R integral, you can also use it to project some mitigation invariant observables.
Right? That's right.
Does that help at all with the sub-algebra problem?
Does it help with the?
It doesn't come up at all for you?
We do use that, actually, but it doesn't help with the subalgebra problem. No, it doesn't do that. Oh, you mean like projecting first and then multiplying or something?
For example,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think that helps. It doesn't help in any natural way.
Any more questions?